Our next matter is the Patrick Gerald Martini petitioner appellant versus the Commissioner of Public Safety as respondent. Our file number A190329. And council reminded, of course, that each party will be given up to 15 minutes for their initial presentation, 5 additional minutes for rebuttal by appellant. If you would please announce yourself, your full name, for our record when you approach the podium, we appreciate that, and do be mindful of the time as noted on the podium. And as soon as counsel for appellant is ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Patrick Martini, in this matter. Appellant is raising a due process challenge to his license revocation, and there's two different standards that this could conceivably be looked at, but whether it's the McDonnell standard or the standard under Matthews v. Eldridge, the underlying theme is that the question is fundamental fairness. That's why we have these due process standards, is did this embody fundamental fairness? It's a situation where Mr. Martini was told something that was not true, and he detrimentally relied upon that untruth.
Well, he was told there was something that wasn't true. He was given a document that was true.
Correct.
What case law have you found anywhere, I didn't see any cited in your brief, that would indicate that a proper written notice and an inaccurate written notice and an inaccurate oral representation by an official given at the same time creates a due process issue at all?
Absolutely none. I do believe this. It's very close.
Thank you for your candor.
It's not a case of first impression, but it is close, and that's why.
It feels like a case of first impression on that issue.
And it might very well be, but I mean, it's very tightly hemmed in between McDonnell, which dealt with misleading statements by law enforcement and the progeny that led to McDonnell.
But in that case, you actually had the officer was issuing the only representation that was given, which was consistent with the written implied consent law. In this case, you have the officer giving a representation that is inconsistent with a formal document that was handed to your client.
Correct. And then you've got the additional distinction that the district court made that in McDonnell it was pre-test and that this happened after the test. So there is nothing directly on point.
What was the purpose of the written document provided to your client, notice of revocation?
Well, and it was to advise him of what his rights and obligations were under the implied consent law. As the court's aware, it told him he had his right to judicial review, right to administrative review, how long the revocation was. And when you look at that document, you see it starts out on the top, says no temporary license issued. The other bold language also says you don't have any right to drive in Minnesota. And then you've got the smaller fine print that says this doesn't kick in, and then lists a date that's 7 days down the road.
Well,
and
fine print or not, it's still in print.
And it is. And that's why I wanted to emphasize that when we're raising a due process challenge, I mean, this is a pre-hearing extrajudicial property taking. I mean, the question really is fundamental fairness. And the officer himself, the trooper, testified that, yeah, I messed that up. I mean, the trooper knew what the form said.
So why is that? I mean, usually fundamental fairness, due process, those don't usually arise from a mistaken reference, but some intentional conduct intended to mislead or an attempt to declare the law, but the law is flawed. Even apart from a conflicting written notice and oral notice, I didn't see any cases cited in your brief where you had just a mistake, where there was no offsetting written notice to correct the mistake, where there was a due process determination,
I don't think any case in Minnesota, none that I could find
or anywhere
elsewhere
in the country. I mean, due process applies everywhere.
Actually came up where the officer, and this argument is going forward, you know, regardless of officer intent. We're not alleging that the officer maliciously did this to Mr. Martini. But the standard we're looking for is to perhaps elaborate a little bit on McDonnell and say, when you've got an officer who's not supposed to be giving legal advice, specifically going outside of the law to incorrectly tell somebody they lack a right that they actually have, and that person detrimentally relies on that incorrect statement of the law, that the only appropriate remedy is rescission.
Counsel, what? You're elaborating on McDonnell, but didn't the Supreme Court in Johnson elaborate on McDonnell and basically say that there's not a due process violation merely because a driver was misled by something an officer said? That in fact, they listed the prongs, none of which apply to your client's situation.
In the Johnson and the Morehouse cases, the elaboration was this detrimental reliance component, saying it's not enough that somebody was misled, that the statement was actually misleading, but also that the person detrimentally relied. And that's why they said, you know, if somebody refused, well, then under those circumstances, the misleading statement wasn't relied on, so it doesn't matter. And I believe it was in the Morehouse out of the two where the court said there was no testimony presented that this individual actually detrimentally relied on the misleading statement, which is why we're not going to rescind the revocation. And so that's what we're asking for in terms of the elaboration is the three-part. Somebody had a right under the law, the officer misleadingly told them something else, and then they detrimentally relied upon that.
But your detrimental reliance has nothing to do with the revocation. Your detrimental reliance is the cost of an Uber.
Well, the detrimental reliance is that, you know, this is a pre-hearing deprivation, and short of a time machine, I mean, you can't go back and make Mr. Martini whole.
But the reliance that was at issue in the cases that you're relying upon was reliance that led to behavior that affected some substantial legal right, providing evidence to the state to be used in a criminal proceeding or in a revocation proceeding. In this case, as Judge Kalatowski points out, that the reliance was at most a decision not to drive a rental car for one trip. There's no legal consequence to that. There's no legal harm unless you can point to one.
No, and that's where the district court drew the line, was the detrimental reliance on something that was stated after the test was taken, you know, when there's still a lot of due process yet to be provided. I mean, you get to have a hearing within 60 days. You do, and the Supreme Court in Minnesota has repeatedly analyzed this 7 days of driving as a due process right when evaluating whether the statute complies with due process. They have repeatedly looked specifically at that and said, yes, that's also a component as to why we're finding this statute constitutional. So I think it's a significant component, especially in a case where somebody is traveling in from out of state and suddenly finds themselves unable to drive in a foreign city and you've got a plane to catch. And it's not as though the state somehow completely loses out. I mean, at this point, Mr. Martini had served his entire revocation before he got to this hearing. And in addition, there's criminal charges where this defense doesn't make a lick of difference in the world, and the state can convict him and he can be revoked.
What is the status of the criminal proceeding?
I believe it's still proceeding. I was thinking about that today. I don't think that's resolved.
Mootness issue is not, we're not,
it's not moot.
There's no question of moot at this point.
Yeah, no, I believe it's still proceeding. There's some issues with the administration of the test that weren't available at the time this hearing was held. But that's why the fundamental fairness under the due process clause is so important, is because this is taking place not in a criminal proceeding where a judge is sitting on the bench telling somebody you've got the right to an attorney, you've got the right to remain silent, and you've got all these procedural hearings. I mean, it's all happening in the station house where the officer that just arrested somebody like Mr. Martini effectively is the law. And when the officer's telling you, yeah, you can't drive anymore, I would certainly follow the officer over my interpretation of the smaller print on a form, which largely seems to back up what he's saying. And so that's where, again, I think the fundamental fairness comes in, and that's why.
When you say which largely seems to back up what he's saying, it doesn't back, it conflicts with what he's saying.
insofar as there is that little bit of language, but again, everything...
When you say little bit of language, a little bit of language says the revocation begins on a date certain, which is not when the officer says it begins. Doesn't that, I mean, perhaps, I mean, I think your case would, I don't know if it would be compelling, but at least it would have significantly more weight if there hadn't been a written instruction. If all that your client had to go on was this official statement, it sounds like an official statement from a uniformed police officer, a trooper, that this is when your revocation begins. But why doesn't the conflict create at least put the burden on your client to investigate the issue of when the revocation begins?
Yeah, and I would hope that if there was no notice and order or revocation, that I wouldn't even be standing here, that would have been a sort of a legal no-brainer. But this document is confusing because you do have the one line that says the privilege revokes on 3/24 at 3:31 a.m. I mean, that is there. It's undisputed. The officer didn't understand that. But, I mean, you have it bracketed by other language, and just looking at it as an average individual, no legal training, where it says no temporary license issued. I mean, they don't know the implied consent law. And then below that, when your driving privileges are revoked, you cannot drive in Minnesota. Like, they're keying in on those phrases, no temp license issued, cannot drive in Minnesota.
I cannot drive in Minnesota at a particular date.
And I'm not disputing. I mean, that language is undoubtedly there, but taking this as a whole, on top of being handed this document after the officer just specifically said, you can't drive anymore. I mean, on the whole of that, I think that's the due process. That's the fundamental fairness, where we can't expect everybody, spur of the moment like this, to read all the fine print and then say, well, the officer that arrested me said one thing.
Not spur of the moment. I mean, presumably he's incarcerated overnight or for some period of time he's released. At some point in time, he's got the notice. He gets a look at the notice before he makes a decision to call Uber or get to the airport in some other way. I mean, it's not a spur of the moment. It's a written document.
Well, it's a written document that he wouldn't have had while he was in custody. That would have been given to him after he was released. And now I'm kind of telling a jury story, but I mean, the fact is that he's sitting there thinking the whole time he's in custody, I can't drive. What am I going to do? He's making his plans. There's no evidence in the record as to how closely he actually read this. He did testify that, yeah, I did read it. But he went by what the officer told him and said, last thing I want to do is get arrested again for driving on a revoked license. I got a flight to catch. If anything, he was playing it ultra safe. And again, we generally want to trust what law enforcement agents are telling us. And part of the problem is the form is very confusing. I mean, this is a Minnesota state trooper. A lot of their job is processing DWI arrests, and he didn't even understand this. And I don't think, again, I think it's contrary to fundamental fairness to say, yeah, the trooper didn't understand it, but we expect Mr. Martini to understand it. And again, in this situation, it's not a harm to public safety. Not that I even think that should be a concern when it comes to due process, but in this pre-hearing revocation, Mr. Martini still served his whole revocation period. In fact, the state got 7 extra days out of him because he wasn't driving on their roads, or 1 because he did fly out of the state. And he still has a criminal proceeding pending. This isn't a defense that comes up in a criminal case. It's unique to these pre-hearing deprivations, where I think it is of the utmost importance to make sure people are being treated fairly. And if an officer does fundamentally misstate one of the rights or legal obligations that somebody has, there needs to be a redress for that. And that's why we're arguing that this court should interpret McDonald to say that, you know, when law enforcement misleads somebody about a right they have under the law and they can prove detrimental reliance, the appropriate remedy is the same as it was in McDonald, the same as it was in Fedzik when people were denied a hearing within 60 days. It's rescission. And that's what we're asking this court to hold. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and present your argument.
And good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. William Young, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Commissioner. At the outset, I want to just briefly respond to a question asked by Judge Ross. You had asked about any cases about potentially misleading forms that were given during the process. I would refer you to the Pace case that was cited on page 10 of respondent's brief. It was an unpublished case from, I believe, April of this year by this court, in which a driver, he was a snowmobiler, had crashed a snowmobile, and there was some misunderstanding by the officer about whether there should have been an immediate revocation. One was eventually mailed to him in the mail, but for some reason, the form that was mailed to him was missing the backside of the page, which told him about the how to do the administrative review and the judicial review, all that information. And this court held that that did not violate both neither the statute nor due process. So I would point you to that case. I also...
Did you find any published opinions?
No. I agree with Mr. Kohler about that. I'm not aware of any published decisions. There was one other unpublished decision by this court from last year, and I'm completely spacing on the name, but it was a case where the wrong fax number was on a form given to a person, not an implied consent, but in a 117.19 challenge where they were trying to lift the total abstinence restriction on their license. So they faxed the form to DPS, or they thought they did, but it went to the wrong place. And this court again held that was not a violation. So I can point you to those two unpublished cases, but I'm not aware of any published decisions. I want to briefly talk about a couple of the facts that were addressed earlier today. On page 20 of the transcript, Mr. Martini testified that he was released at 7 a.m. On page 18, he testified that he read the notice of revocation earlier that night. There's no record evidence about whether he was able to keep that with him during the 3:31 to 7 a.m. period between when it was printed and when he was released, but presumably he read it. We don't know if he had it the entire 3.5-hour window, if he had it and had to give it back. That's not really in the record, but he did say he had read it. I'd also note that on the notice and order of revocation, there's the language that has been called confusing, but at the very top where it says no temporary license issued, that's not inaccurate. He wasn't given a temporary license because he didn't have a Minnesota license in the first place. There was no temporary Minnesota license to give him. While there's been some statements today about how he served his entire revocation period, presumably he was in Oregon, in which case this revocation doesn't even affect him. So he was out the one day or the portion of that day getting to the airport, but beyond that, there's really nothing in the record to show that he was out the rest of the time.
Well, I think the argument, I don't want to misstate it, but is that there's a constitutional, what makes the statute constitutional is that there is a period of time before a hearing where the revocation doesn't set in, so that there's a grace period essentially built into the statute so that you don't have a pre-hearing deprivation. And I think the argument is that in this case, there was no, that period wasn't allowed by relying upon the officer's representation as to what the revocation period is and when it begins. So I'm not sure that it matters whether, to that particular argument, whether he was in Oregon or Minnesota, because the argument is that there was no window, there was no gap. The argument is that gap is constitutionally required for the statute to be constitutional.
And I believe it was you, Your Honor, it may have been Judge Kalatowski, but had asked sort of what was the harm, trying to get at the actual harm suffered here. And sort of in response to your question or your statement, that statutory requirement is that 7-day grace period. Here we have the record reflects that he went to Oregon during that first day. We presumably he didn't come back, but we don't know. He may have come back that night. The U.S. Supreme Court in Mackey v. Montrum upheld the constitutionality of Massachusetts' law that didn't have that grace period. And in all the subsequent Minnesota Supreme Court cases discussing procedural due process under the analyzing the implied consent law, Hamilton, Davis, Hedden, they've said that Minnesota provides more they provide more sort of opportunities to ensure the fairness to the driver. There's the grace period, but there's also some other things, the limited license that weren't in Mackey. None of the cases, and I believe this court in Williams in 2013 said the 7-day period isn't the keystone that holds the whole thing in place. It's just one of the many things that can be considered when doing the due process analysis.
What is the relationship between Oregon's between Minnesota's revocation and potential enforcement in Oregon? Is there reciprocity state to state so that a revocation in Minnesota, of the right to drive in Minnesota, would also restrict the right to drive in Oregon, or is that?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that there is what's called the Interstate Compact that Minnesota is a part of, and I don't believe it's all 50 states. I believe it's like 48 or 49. It's just about all of them. In which case they honor and acknowledge a license revocation, suspension, cancellation from one when a person is trying to be licensed in another state. But I know, for example, in Minnesota, from my understanding, they're not proactively going to be drawing on them. They don't run a search every single day. What happens is if a driver goes to renew or to apply for the first time, that's when they'll do the nationwide search. And so presumably, unless Mr. Martini has had to renew his license, this wouldn't have even really been flagged by Oregon. But again, I don't know that for certain. That's just my understanding of how it works in Minnesota. Your Honors, I would rely on our submitted brief. If there's no other questions, I would defer the rest of my time.
Very good. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for Appellant, you may provide rebuttal if you wish.
May it please the Court. I don't have much by way of rebuttal. If there are no other questions from the Court, I would just...
Let me throw out one. Do you know the answer to that last question, and that whether your client would have been under revocation in Oregon based upon the revocation in Minnesota, or is it just that in Oregon he can't, during the revocation period, if he tried to renew his license in Oregon, there might be a hiccup at that point?
Yeah, Mr. Young hasn't been in the public safety division for a while, but I think he got it exactly right. Like, it will be reported to Oregon at some point. I don't know on the facts of this case when that happened. I've seen it happen as soon as a week. I've seen it take longer. It's usually before somebody goes for a renewal. The states communicate better than that. It used to be more the way Mr. Young described it, but I don't actually know when it was reported to Oregon. I do know, and this is outside the record, that it eventually was, and that the revocation was served on his Oregon license as well.
For the same period?
I don't recall. Typically, it's whatever the state, the foreign jurisdiction's penalty is for the first-time DWI is what's imposed on the actual Oregonian license.
So before that notice of the suspension of the Oregon license, your client would have had the right to continue driving in Oregon?
Correct. Yeah, until Oregon took action against him, the only limit.
But it's not automatic. The state actually has to act on it.
Correct. Yeah, and pursuant to due process, yeah, they have to give him the, I shouldn't speak of Oregon law. I assume they would need to give him notice, and there may even be a waiting period. But in this case, the harm was not necessarily having to rent an Uber. The harm was the denial of driving privileges he was legally entitled to. I mean, Mr. Martini was legally entitled to drive on Minnesota roads. So his testimony was just to establish the detrimental reliance, but the actual harm, the actionable harm, as was stated in the Williams case, is the fact that he was denied driving privileges when he was entitled to them under the law.
For essentially one trip?
Yeah, effectively, a period of hours. I also don't know when his flight was, but just as Williams said, even one day loss of license is an actionable harm under the due process clauses. Like, that is the argument here.
What was his, do we know what his, I know what the record I think says his blood alcohol, his concentration was over 0.08. Do we know what that number was?
I know it was less than a 0.15 or a 0.16 because the revocation was only for 90 days.
We don't know that.
Off the top of my head, I think he was a 1.0 or an 0.09. He wasn't particularly high.
I was going to suggest if he was high enough, then he wouldn't have been able to drive anyway during that period.
Well, and there were actually questions in the record on that point where he was released after blowing zeros. So he clearly wasn't too high because he was legally able to drive once he was released from custody. And that it's actually good that that's in there because that does demonstrate that he actually could have exercised that right without violating Minnesota law. But if there are no other questions from the Court, I would just respectfully request that the Court reverse the District Court in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel, and thank you both, Counsel, and we appreciate your comments today and the briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement. We will be adjourning now to address our non-oral calendar. You each have a good day.
All rise.